Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, April 4th, 2025, we're delighted to host a Courthouse Steps oral argument program on Medina versus Planned Parenthood South Atlantic, which was argued earlier this week before the Supreme Court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guest today brief, certainly more brief than the careers would deserve. So I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Eric Wesson, who serves as Iowa's Solicitor General in the Iowa Attorney General's Office. In that role, Mr. Wesson leads Iowa's litigation before state and federal appellate courts, including the Iowa and U.S. Supreme Courts. Before that role, Mr. Wesson worked on complex commercial litigation at two large law firms in Chicago. Also, joining us today as our moderator for today's conversation is Ryan Banger, who serves as Senior Vice President for Strategic Initiatives and Special Counsel to the President at Alliance Defending Freedom. In that role, he oversees ADF's government affairs and corporate engagement teams, as well as the Blackstone Legal Fellowship team. He also advises executive leadership with strategic initiatives and appears as counsel for ADF clients. Before joining ADF, Mr. Banger served as Deputy First Assistant Attorney General and Deputy for Legal Counsel in the Office of the Texas Attorney General. And I will leave it there. A last note, throughout the program, if you have any questions, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to the discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Banger, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Kayla. It's a pleasure to be with everyone today, and of course, a tremendous pleasure to be with my friend Eric Wesson, the fantastic Solicitor General for the state of Iowa. And before we start our conversation today, I want to get a few disclaimers out of the way. My colleague, John Bursch, argued the case on behalf of the petitioner, Eunice Medina, and so he was certainly there at the U.S. Supreme Court and provided capable argument on behalf of petitioners. Eric, of course, works in the Iowa SG. He's the Iowa SG, works in the Iowa Attorney General's office. And his principal, Attorney General Byrd, filed an amicus brief along with several other states in support of petitioners. Eric, with that, I certainly want to ask you about the stakes of this case. So right off the bat, the question presented in this case, and I'm quoting directly from the grant and from the cert petition, whether the Medicaid Act's any qualified provider provision unambiguously confers a private right upon a Medicaid beneficiary to choose a specific provider. So unpack that for us for a moment, Eric. What's at stake in this case? What is this any qualified provider provision? And why are we concerned about whether or not it confers a private right of action?
Absolutely. Thank you, Ryan, for asking. And thank you, Federalist Society, for having us have this conversation. It's interesting because when you look at a caption like Medina v. Planned Parenthood, the first assumption is that the subject matter of the lawsuit is going to be about abortion, because Planned Parenthood is right there. But taking a step back into the actual issue here in the case, abortion doesn't play a direct role. It's really a question about when the spending clause creates a cause of action under Section 1983 that is justiciable and enforceable in the form of a private lawsuit. But then taking one more step back, ultimately, this case does come back to abortion because going back all the way to 2018, South Carolina decided that one of the questions it had when it was deciding eligibility for participation in some of its federally government-funded medical programs included whether the applicant here, Planned Parenthood, is a major provider of abortion. And it found that no, that would not qualify. So that 2018 decision by the governor was sort of the starting shot in what has become more of a marathon than a sprint. Now in 2025, the case is up at the U.S. Supreme Court for the second time after having gone up to the Fourth Circuit I think three times and multiple decisions in the district court below. So ultimately, the question is whether Planned Parenthood can sue the state of South Carolina for declining to allow it to participate in its Medicare program. And the reason that that is a question is because Section 1983 creates a cause of action to sue if someone's rights have been violated under federal or constitutional law. And so under the spending clause, then the question becomes, is there a right here that has been violated? In recent years, the US Supreme Court has nibbled around the edges of this question. It seems now, based on the argument, and I'm sure we'll get there, that it is squarely presented for them to hopefully give some guidance to the court below. But what the district court and then the Fourth Circuit found in its multiple kind of trips back and forth are that the Medicare statute or the Medicare Medicaid statute give certain rights and monies to the state. And in return for accepting that money, they also accept the liability for lawsuit if they violate certain laws. And one of the laws here is, I believe it was 1396A or 1396.3. But basically the underlying idea here is that one of the conditions of the funds is that individuals are able to choose a provider of their choice. And then the question is whether that gives the individuals the right to choose Planned Parenthood as a provider. So under different US Supreme Court precedents, specifically Wilder and Blessing, going back a little further, and then Tlebsky from 2023, there is a real tension as to whether under 1983, there's a cause of action to enforce a perceived violation of those rights. And
I want to jump in there, Eric, really quickly, because that you raise a really important point. As these, as the case was going through this slow and torturous path from the district court up to the Supreme Court, back to the Fourth Circuit over and over again, almost like a voice crying in the wilderness was Judge Richardson on the three judge panel saying over and over again to the US Supreme Court, clarify the rule of law with respect to, or clarify the rule with respect to how we evaluate whether a federal spending clause statute allows for a plaintiff to bring a Section 1983 claim. And the real legal analysis there is, of course, Section 1983 allows a private cause of action if a right or privilege has been violated, it's been created by statutory federal statutory law. And this oftentimes creates this, this conundrum, this problem, because federal spending clauses very rarely, federal spending clause statutes very rarely say, plaintiff, you have a right to bring a cause of action under Section 1983. Congress just doesn't write statutes like that. So oftentimes the courts are left in this position of evaluating the text and the structure of the statute to ascertain whether or not the statute does allow for this Section 1983 claim by creating a federal right. And Judge Richardson, in consistently concurring with the panel, but pointing out, we have a problem here. We have a problem because it's very difficult based on the existing case law from the U.S. Supreme Court. And as the cases went up and down, of course, Tlebsky intervened. But Richardson said over and over again, we don't really know what the rule is here. We have a concacophony of varying decisions, none of which really cohere together. And so talk a little bit about how that problem of ambiguity and uncertainty was likely something that drove the Supreme Court to grant the cert in this case.
Yeah, I guess the Supreme Court already granted cert once when it granted vacated and remanded in light of Tlebsky. But one surprisingly recurring aspect of appellate litigation that I have found is that when a court is reversed on appeal, but the appellate court does not give its reasoning, the original court often likes to just reapply the same legal standard it did last time until it's told not to. And that seems to be what happened here. There's a certain type of path dependence that comes, the Fourth Circuit, for three very smart judges on the Fourth Circuit came to a result And yes, Judge Richardson, crying in the wilderness, said, what are we supposed to do with these aged precedents that do not clearly give us a path forward? And then it goes up to the Supreme Court and the posture changes, and basically they GVR in light of Tlaibsky. And Tlaibsky is interesting. We should probably talk a little bit about what that case did. But on remand, the Fourth Circuit comes to the same result, says that there is a cause of action that the plaintiffs can sue, and nothing in Tlaibsky, which does try at least to reconcile some of the older precedents without necessarily overruling them, explain that there has to be a very high bar for rights creating language to allow for a lawsuit under 1983 for spending clause laws. Here in the Planned Parenthood case coming out of South Carolina, and this came up at the argument, it's not really clear what additional strength above just creating some language, or enacting some language is for the plaintiffs to rely on that sets that bar higher than what would be the same in any other context. And so the spending clause issue of what is the clear enough statement, or what are the magic words that need to be in a law that create a private right of action, remains, at least for purposes of the Fourth Circuit, unclear. And it's unclear enough that Judge Richardson was comfortable concurring in the judgment and concurring in the opinion, allowing the suit to proceed, but still not comfortable enough for him to decline to write yet again. Tell us what the standard are, tell us what law there is to apply, and hopefully this time, and it seems like there is some appetite, at least at the Supreme Court, for this, there will be some stronger guidance for the courts of appeals as to when an implied right of action can be found hidden in spending clause litigation, such that 1983 allows a lawsuit to proceed.
Well, let's talk a little bit, and it's a great setup for talking about how the parties frame the arguments going into oral argument in their briefing. And of course, a lot of this did turn on how you read Tlaibsky. So I think we can't avoid talking a little bit about Tlaibsky. And Tlaibsky, of course, was a very recent Supreme Court decision that addressed this very question about when a statute creates a right sufficient to give a plaintiff the ability to go into court under Section 1983. And of course, on the one hand, you have Justice Alito saying, well, spending clause statutes create the ability for a plaintiff to go into court under 1983 because they don't create rights. They're simply conditions on spending or conditions on the receipt of federal funds spent by states. But so setting those two aside, how did the rest of the court address that question in Tlaibsky?
Yeah, and I think, you know, maybe it also is helpful to look at how the different parties framed this in their briefs. So first, the petitioners here, South Carolina, argued that the blessing test was not the best way to look at how spending clause private rights of action should be allowed to proceed. And that was a multi-factor test that was certainly would have been at home in an earlier iteration of the Supreme Court, but is in tension with a lot of the more recent jurisprudence that seems to be consistently edging closer to bright line rules than towards multi-factor tests. And there, the question is whether the free choice of provider language in the statute imposes an obligation on South Carolina, which I think both sides would agree it imposes some type of obligation, but whether that obligation was a right in the term of art sense, such that there is an availability of a cause of action under Section 1983. And some of the reasons that the plaintiffs thought that maybe that isn't the case include the may obtain language. So one of the phrases that got a lot of discussion at the argument was that one may obtain care, that does not sound like mandatory language. The alternative means for relief. So 1983 can be used to enforce a right, but there was a whole alternative framework, a whole alternative scheme in the state court system going up through administrative review that could have allowed Planned Parenthood to, if it was correct, eventually vindicate its right to provide care without running straight to federal court. And really just this goes back to some of the strong language in Justice Jackson's Tlaibsky opinion about just how high the bar is to find the creation of an implied right of action. So on the other side, the respondents in their briefing said that giving a free choice of provider confers a private right of access, and saying that any individual may obtain care from a qualified provider has an individual focus, such that the individual, if they can't obtain care from an otherwise qualified provider, that perhaps that gives them the right to sue. And of course, there's the fact that the alternative administrative denial framework is not available to individuals as to the denial of the provider, just as to questions about their own care. And then there's the sort of underlying legislative history question of what is the ill that the statute was trying to solve. And while there are certainly justices that are less attuned to that, there was a fair amount of discussion about what Congress was intending to do. I don't believe the phrase legislative acquiescence was actually used at argument, but there was sort of skirting around the question of when Congress changed the law to put this language in, what was it trying to do? And that was one of the questions that was really being wrestled with. So when it comes to how to deal with Tlaibsky, there is this tension because at least to me, it seemed like the author of Tlaibsky seems likely to vote against South Carolina, but it did not seem like anyone at argument could articulate why the law in question had met an especially high bar for rights creating language, and why, if the bar is not set at a place where this case would allow for a cause of action, pretty much all spending clause laws that gave a benefit would not also confer a right to sue for a lack or an alleged lack of that benefit. And I think that's really the heart of where the clash was between the two sides.
Sure. And so I think that's a great moment for us to pivot to the oral argument. But before we do that, for the audience's sake, I'd like to read the language of the any qualified provider portion of the Medicaid statute, because I think it's relevant to understanding how the argument went. And so it's a very simple statute, 42 U.S.C. 1396A, Part A, 23A. And it states in relevant part, a state plan for medical assistance must provide that any individual eligible for medical assistance, so a beneficiary of Medicaid, for instance, may obtain such assistance from any provider qualified to perform the service or services required, who undertakes to provide him such services. And so the key elements of this are, if you are a Medicaid beneficiary, the statute provides that a state plan for medical assistance must provide that beneficiary, quote, may obtain such assistance from any provider qualified. And of course, the problem for the respondents here was that the state of South Carolina had deemed Planned Parenthood unqualified to provide such services. And so the question was whether or not the beneficiary of services could bring a challenge under Section 1983 to reinsert Planned Parenthood into the state plan. And so launching into the argument, of course, my colleague John Birch went first, and there were a couple of very interesting, I think, pieces of that argument. Very quickly, Justice Sotomayor jumped in, and she very quickly accused Mr. Birch of relying on what she called a magic words analysis. And Justice Kavanaugh later picked up the same vocabulary, magic words, later in the argument, but in a more positive way. And so explain to the audience a little bit, what was this battle over, quote unquote, magic words in the context of Tlaibsky in determining whether or not the any qualified provider provision creates the ability to bring a Section 1983 lawsuit?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's kind of funny because listening to the argument, the emphasis on whether, or I guess the absolute value of the phrase magic words remained constant, but the hostility or positivity towards those words was highly variable. Magic words in this case amount to a very clear statement rule. And ultimately, whether that very clear statement rule requires being so clear that it is limited to a closed set of just a couple words. So here, Justice Sotomayor seemed skeptical that Congress could be limited in how it chose to phrase its laws such that it would have to use a word like right or privilege or immunity to confer an authority to sue under Section 1983. On the exact opposite end of the spectrum, Justice Kavanaugh, perhaps recognizing not only this case, but also two similar cases coming out of the Fifth Circuit that led to the opposite result eventually at the en banc Fifth Circuit, was that the current status quo of the jurisprudence has proven unworkable for the courts. And so having a clear statement rule or magic words requirement such that Congress can effectively check a box to signal to the courts 1983 should be available here would actually not only solve judicial efficiency, but at least prospectively would aid Congress in ensuring that when it drafts laws, it knows clearly what the requirements are for how to legislate. And one of the counter arguments to that I believe actually came from Justice Kagan was whether or not that decision today explaining that magic words or a very clear statement was required is a fair imposition on laws passed long ago. And the answer, both, you know, adequately provided by Mr. Bursch, as well as Deputy Solicitor General Hawkins on behalf of the United States, and I think by Justice Kavanaugh, was that very often the U.S. Supreme Court applies textual rules and how it interprets laws today to laws that were passed not only at the same time as the statute in question here, but even statutes that are much older. And so while there may be a sort of unfairness, and I think the F word was thrown about in that way at the argument, ultimately, this is a great way for the court and for Congress to have a conversation. And the clearer the court is in establishing ground rules and explaining what is needed to achieve certain results today, I think that Justice Kavanaugh was very persuasive that that will be the best benefit to Congress going forward. Now, the pushback to that, and I think Justice Sotomayor hit this hard, was there's a real interbranch separation of powers question. You know, who is the Supreme Court to tell Congress what words it must use in order to legislate? And I think the answer to that is at least under current Supreme Court precedent, going back to Marbury versus Madison, the Supreme Court is exactly there to tell Congress what words it can use in order to legislate. And if it uses the wrong words that impose an unconstitutional or impermissible result, then the Supreme Court historically in the context of our country has been the branch of government to tell Congress that is improper and to try again. And there are a few different examples of that conversation going back and forth, some of which I would say are more positive than others. Maybe the most obvious one that comes to my mind is in the context of the federal RFRA statute and then the City of Boerne case, where Congress passes a law, and the original RFRA statute was passed almost unanimously, signed into law by President Bill Clinton. And then after the Supreme Court basically limited its applicability, Congress tried again, and with RLUIPA tried to give some federal religious liberty protections. And I think that the answer is that anytime one of these cases comes out and the Supreme Court tells Congress that what you did for whatever reason doesn't work, hopefully they are clear, Congress can take that and incorporate that instruction into their legislating and achieve the same or often the same substantive ends, depending on if that substantive end itself is constitutional, but do so through a means and mechanism with a respect for process that ensures that their actions carry forward. And I think that's exactly one way or the other is what's going to happen here. Whether South Carolina wins or loses this case, Congress is going to have at least some probably direct, but maybe indirect evidence about what it needs to do when legislating in order to ensure that its prerogatives will be respected.
And you raise a really interesting point about some of the separation of powers, the federalism arguments that were latent within the arguments, in fact, in many cases expressed within the arguments, which really turned on more of a textualist analysis of the text of the statute. And so it was a very interesting sort of nesting doll situation. You certainly had Mr. Bursch arguing that, at least with respect to states who are accepting funds under spending clause statutes, they need clear notice of what the obligations are. Because if they don't have clear notice of their obligations and are subsequently learned that there's an obligation buried within a condition on receipt of funds they didn't know about, that could cause real federalism problems. There are also some separation of powers issues that were brought up throughout the argument, whether or not the courts were the ones, as you just mentioned, this argument about whether or not the courts are the ones to properly prescribe magic words, so to speak, for Congress to use to allow access to Section 1983, and of course, the counterargument being, of course, the courts are the ones who declare the effect of the law, the words used by Congress. And I think that was just Justice Kavanaugh's point in that colloquy that you just described. But there were also some very interesting, just very minute textual controversies that were raging throughout the argument, one of which was an argument that was raised by Justice Kagan during a colloquy with Mr. Bursch, where they were meditating on the effect of the creation of benefits and whether or not that necessarily implied or created correlative rights. And what I mean by that is this discussion was raised in the context of the any qualified provider statute and its effect and its intended effect by Congress. The respondents here, Planned Parenthood, argued repeatedly throughout that the creation of the statute intended to confer a benefit to individuals, Medicaid beneficiaries, that conferred upon them a right to access care from any qualified provider of their choice. Conversely, Mr. Bursch, and of course the state of South Carolina, argued repeatedly that the creation of this obligation on the part of the states to provide access to these providers was just that. It was a benefit to a class of people that was required to be part of a state plan, but that benefit did not create any correlative rights. Now, that's a jumble of words. Can you please unpack for us what was going on there in this conversation about, are these benefits without rights? Are these benefits that necessarily create correlative rights? And quite frankly, does the argument of the respondents here, Planned Parenthood, if accepted, would that just simply eviscerate or blow away this high standard or high bar that Tlaibski purported to create?
Yes, it would. And this goes back to what we were just talking about the magic words. And I think you talking about the jumble of what the statute did and all that you have to do to explain is precisely the problem that Justice Kavanaugh seemed like he wanted to resolve by imposing in a positive light, a magic words requirement. And the idea is that Section 1983 does not create a freestanding cause of action to challenge any state action, so long as there is an alleged breach of all federal law. But instead, when it comes to the spending clause context, only where there is a breach of a right. And so depending on how broadly one reads the word right depends on how broad the potential, you know, abrogation of state sovereign immunity in some of these cases, how broad the potential liability is for states that agree to sign up for these programs are. And states don't always take the money. There are a lot of programs, and most famously, perhaps in recent times, or not so recent anymore, but with the Affordable Care Act, there was a lot of money that was available in return for starting or accepting certain exchange-related programs and processes. And a lot of states at the time, and to this day, some states still do, declined to take those funds. And the reason is they didn't want to be obligated to follow some of the requirements that would follow along with that. So too here, where if the states are accepting these funds, and I guess, you know, I believe it was Justice, I forget which justice, one of them noted that these funds are not quite mandatory, but every state does take these funds. And so in response, opens themselves up to the potential liability here. Finding out what
Justice Alito talking about the, you know, the voluntary slash not so voluntary.
Yeah, voluntary. I thought it was Justice Alito, but I wasn't sure. The voluntary, but not so voluntary nature. If any benefit necessarily comes with a right to sue, that imposes a huge potential font of liability on the states that accept funding. And it is not at all clear that that was what was intended. And going back to the history and the nature of actions at law, it is just not the case that every violation necessarily came with a legal remedy. If I recall correctly, one of the original reasons for the creation of equity courts was to fill in the gaps for some of those areas where there was not an adequate remedy at law. And so here, the idea that just by virtue of in effect, and I think a few justices refer to this, like creating a contract between the federal government and the state, that it would endow a third party with authority to enforce not only not a term of the contract, but an optional or non-mandatory term of the contract, seems odd and out of place. And that is why there was some of that strong language in Justice Jackson's Tlaibsky opinion, limiting the circumstances when such a lawsuit could proceed. And that's really what it seems like Justice Kavanaugh was trying to get at here. And he seemed to be the most gung-ho about this, you know, rather than allowing Pandora's box to be opened, let's just keep it shut. We will, you know, poke some air holes and say, here's the way that Congress can legislate to allow for these lawsuits to follow. And going forward, Congress can do that. And looking back historically, states that did not necessarily think they were opening themselves up to liability won't have done so. Because one thing that I thought was interesting about the argument is there was a lot of conversation about the reasonable expectations of Congress, but there wasn't quite so much about the reasonable expectations of states that were signing up and accepting to receive these funds. And if their expectations at the time were not that they were opening themselves up to potential liability to have to accept any medical provider in the state that believes itself to be qualified or to provide services that the state does not itself want to provide, then it seems odd to have such a one-way view of what the reasonable expectations in this pseudo contract situation are.
Certainly. And so I think you really, as you can see from the conversation we've had so far, the real rub of the nub of the dispute between the parties was whether or not the language of the statute, the any qualified provider statute, met the requirements of Tlaibsky, whatever those requirements happened to be. And it seemed like the parties at least were in rough agreement that Tlaibsky created a demanding bar, in the words of the case, that it required unambiguous conferral of individual federal rights, particularly a right that would be sufficient to activate Section 1983. And there was another piece of language from Tlaibsky. It said that a provision that creates such rights must contain clear rights creating language. And so the nature of the dispute between the parties really revolved narrowly around those requirements. But there were some other interpretive aids that were also discussed throughout the argument, in addition to the text of the statute itself. And one of them was this notion of whether the text of the statute, whether it mattered that it was embedded in what was called a substantial compliance regime. And could you talk a little bit about this idea of substantial compliance, the fact that a state had to substantially, but not perfectly, comply with the conditions of the Medicaid statute, and why that was relevant to whether or not the any qualified provider provision, which was part of that regime, created rights enforceable under Section 1983?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's been a lot of scholarship on this recently, but in the current constitutional moment that we live in, rights are very deeply protected by the Constitution. And so I think a lot of people take that depth of protection and apply it to other areas where the word right or the concept of rights are applicable. So here, if there is a right, even if it's a right conferred through language other than the word right, then presumably there should be a lot of protection and a lot of solicitude to ensure that someone whose right is being violated can sue to remedy that wrong. But the question here is, in a substantial compliance regime where it is not even clear that there must be perfect, I think Mr. Birch said, there need not be compliance to every jot and tittle of the statute. And in a case like this, where the federal government has never found a violation by the state, even if there is potentially significant lack of compliance, and as was sort of explored at the argument, that there is no right necessarily to force a state into full compliance other than from the Secretary of Health and Human Services himself intervening, you could have a state that was failing to follow all sorts of the requirements of the law. And so I think there was some skepticism that if there is no requirement to follow certain aspects of the law, that it would be odd to say that those requirements imbued a right in the recipient. And that dovetails with some of the discussion and back and forth over the question of may obtain in reference to the choice of a provider. Because again, when one's thinking of rights, at least in this type of context, the frame of reference tends to be mandatory in nature. You must be allowed to have this, or you shall have this. To say that you may have a choice of a doctor or of a qualified provider, may obtain, that is a different and much weaker phrasing. And I thought one interesting aspect of this argument was looking at the divide between both the text and the structure of the statute in question, because the text does confer a benefit. The question then becomes the antecedent one of whether that benefit is a right. But then looking at the structure, you know, how strong is that conferral? And the answer appears to be, based on the statute, not that strong, and that the type of remedies for failure to comply with that conferral might also be not too strong. So it would be very odd to give a provider such a strong potential remedy here when it's not even clear that the federal government could or would want to intercede to enforce that same right. And really the question here is whether the federal government and the state are in agreement as to how to comply with the benefits that are being provided for the individuals or the providers being the object of that pseudo contract, but not necessarily parties to that contract.
Sure. And you can see, I think, that the nuanced and layered nature of the argument as we proceed through this presentation. If you're someone who loves statutory analysis and construction, this case was definitely for you. So we have a question that came in. The question is, because the legislative fix seems so straightforward, must we simply accept the fact that Congress is too divided because of the underlying nexus to abortion to create a legislative fix here? And I think I want to take that question and point to a piece of the argument that I think is relevant to the question. And that is this issue of the suitor fix that was brought up several times throughout the argument. That was simply an instance where Congress went back and clarified through an amendment that the mere fact that a Medicaid requirement appears in a list does not eliminate the possibility that that requirement may create a right. And so there is at least some precedent that Congress can address a Supreme Court case evaluating the upshot or the effect of a statute on the ability of a plaintiff to bring a Section 1983 claim. And so I'm just curious, how do you take that question in terms of we have in at least one instance where Congress has responded in the context of the question of whether Section 1980 language is sufficient to create a Section 1983 claim. And so talk a little bit about the suitor fix issue, but also this broader question of whether or not this is something that could just be obviated or fixed by Congress if it wanted to.
it seems clear to me that Congress could pass a law identifying Section 1983 and saying that suits could or could not be brought under that section. What is a lot less clear to me, both after the argument and reading the briefs, is whether Congress actually wanted people to be able to bring Section 1983 claims under that section. And so the question that we were asked is, a legislative fix seems straightforward. Why doesn't Congress do it? And I'm not sure necessarily that a legislative fix is needed. But ultimately, that's because I'm not sure what Congress's ultimate object was here, whether they did intend to confer that ability to sue on providers and individuals. If they did, even after an adverse decision, it would be very simple to fix. But that goes exactly to the point, I think, that the petitioners in South Carolina and the U.S. are making here, which is that it just isn't clear. And when it's not clear and the language doesn't give you an answer, then the default should be not to find that the federal government is intentionally creating a strong right such that someone could sue in federal court. And if that is the case, then it makes sense to take a step back and wait for Congress to authorize what's going on. And I would say one more thing is that there is also a clear statement rule about abrogating sovereign immunity, and that didn't play a big role in this case. But whether a sovereign immunity, and this is a lawsuit ultimately against the state of South Carolina, should be abrogated also should require some kind of clear intent from Congress to the extent that such abrogation is even constitutionally permissible. And that also doesn't seem to be present here, at least in the parts of this law that were discussed. And I'm sure, you know, there is certainly more in these statutes that I've not looked at. I am not a Medicare or Medicaid expert. I am not a provider expert, but I do think that lurking in the background behind why, you know, Tlaibsky maybe seems attractive here is the idea that under the spending clause, if the state is accepting funds, they should only be allowed to be sued in relatively narrow circumstances out of respect for their sovereignty.
Sure. And so I want to talk a little bit more about another interpretive aid that was raised during the course of the argument. This really came up during the backside of the argument when Ms. Saharsky, the counsel for respondent Planned Parenthood, was at the podium. And it goes to this question of congressional intent. And we also have a question that just popped into the feed here. Does the statute begin with language as to its purpose? Well, the statute doesn't, but at least the any qualified provider provision does not. But it was argued repeatedly and forcefully by Ms. Saharsky that the purpose of the any qualified provider statute, in her view, was to provide beneficiaries with a right, in her view. Of course, the right word right never appears in the statute, but a right to access any provider of his or her choice, up to and including Planned Parenthood. And she forcefully argued that this right, in her view, that was created by the any qualified provider provision necessarily should be enforceable by Section 1983. Otherwise, states could simply willy-nilly disqualify any provider they wanted for any political reason they viewed feasible or any political reason they viewed expedient. And Justice Barrett then turned that around, though, and later asked Ms. Saharsky, she said, well, actually, doesn't that support an intent of Congress not to create a right? Because Congress clearly gave states at least some discretionary authority to disqualify providers, for instance, in instances where providers were committing malpractice. And wouldn't Congress not intend or not want there to be a beneficiary-driven private cause of action under Section 1983 to challenge such clearly discretionary choices on the part of states? And so even there on the intent of Congress point, you had very sharp lines of division in ascertaining what it was that Congress was actually trying to do.
Yeah, and just to respond to that a little bit, I think this goes, you know, to maybe my flaws. You know, I see myself as competent, but maybe not, you know, a super brilliant lawyer. So I like when things are clear and straightforward. And it seems to me like what we have here is a situation where Congress was given the opportunity to, or now has the opportunity to be more clear in its lawmaking going forward. And that ties neatly in to some of what has been discussed earlier. And it ties neatly into this idea that Congress can be clear. There was some discussion at the argument too. Another nearby section of the law involved a Bill of Rights that lays out rights. Congress clearly knows how to use the word right. It knows how to, you know, to make things clear and more straightforward. And it just seems to me that as the court struggles with how to interpret these phrases, the lack of clarity itself counsels against finding a clear right having been established just by virtue of the lack of clarity, right? Even if there isn't a magic words requirement, there still must be some clear statement, some high bar that must be passed under Tlaibsky. And the lack of clarity here seems to preclude meeting that high bar.
Certainly. I know we're running a little short. I want to ask a final question about another interpretive aid that the court turned to. And this was something that they were calling Tlaibsky Step 2. And it really revolved around what is the import or the impact or effect of the provision of alternate remedies for individuals embedded within the statute provided by the state on the interpretation of whether or not the inequalified provider provision created a right. And of course, this old case called Sea Clamors came up several times. And of course, Mr. Bursch very quickly responded. He was not making a Sea Clamors argument, which of course Sea Clamors created a situation where there was a hard prohibition on Section 1983 redress when a statutory scheme provides what in that case called an unusually elaborate enforcement provision. Now that was not an issue here because clearly the Medicaid statute in this instance did not provide an unusually elaborate enforcement provision, but it did provide at least some redress. And that became the subject of much debate at the argument about the import or the effect of these remedies that could be accessed by beneficiaries and providers upon the interpretation of the statute itself. So talk a little bit about what this Tlaibsky Step 2 argument was and what the import of these alternate remedies was on the interpretation of the inequalified provider provision as to whether or not it conferred a right.
There seemed to be a lot of disagreement on the court as to how important the alternative remedy scheme was to finding an answer to the question presented in the case. But to the extent that an alternative remedy or an alternative scheme by which someone can assert their rights ameliorates some of the underlying need for Section 1983, which is almost like a constitutional safety net or backdrop to allow people to come to court when their rights have been violated in a way for which there is not another federal cause of action to bring suit. Here, I think the point that was pretty persuasively made is that while Planned Parenthood wanted to run straight to federal court to try to vindicate its purported right under Section 1983, the availability of administrative relief perhaps is a reason why that was not needed. I don't know South Carolina law as well, but I do know in Iowa that a lot of times certain administrative law related disputes must be funneled through the state administrative process and then the state courts. And there is a mandatory nature to that. You cannot bring an Iowa Administrative Procedures Act in federal court. And so you can still get up and, you know, Mr. Bursch said this, you can get from the administrative decision to the state district court, all the way up to the state Supreme Court, all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. There's still a direct line to eventually get review by the U.S. Supreme Court, just channeled through a different process. And going back, and I think this probably speaks a little bit to the length of the case, it seems like there may have been some earlier back and forth in litigation about whether going through the administrative process itself was futile. A lot of people seem to think that futility means if I disagree with a decision of the executive branch of a state, then I don't have to go to the administrative process. Again, I'm not as familiar with South Carolina law, but that's not how it works in Iowa. If you want to bring an administrative law claim, you got to go through the process, even if you think you're going to lose. And then you can go to state court where our independent judges that are not part of the executive branch will hear your claim, and applying the statutory standard of review will come to a result. And if you think that in that process, there is some federal or constitutional law, federal constitutional law being violated, you can always eventually present that argument to the U.S. Supreme Court. And it may be a slower process, or it may not be, honestly, depending on how fast the federal and state courts are respectively in a given situation. But you still have every an ample ground to make your case. It's just maybe going to be in a slightly different manner than what you'd prefer. And I think that, you know, maybe one other sort of implicit underlying aspect to all of this is a lot of the litigators in these cases, especially working for some of the groups that litigate them, have a lot more experience in federal courts and a lot less experience in state courts. And so their default preference is to be in the forum where they have more familiarity. But that itself was not an issue in this case.
Certainly. And so I'll go out with this last question, talking about things that were not at issue in the case. Certainly, we had this question. The question really on hand that the court was addressing was whether or not a beneficiary, Medicaid beneficiary, could bring a Section 1983 challenge to a state's decision to disqualify a provider and whether that violated the unqualified provider provision. What was not at issue in the case was the scope of a state's authority to disqualify providers and whether what the state of South Carolina did actually was permissible under the statute. So that's an interesting wrinkle in this case, that it's really just a question of access to remedies by a purportedly aggrieved party that the court's addressing. But given that fact, let's assume for sake of argument that the Supreme Court decides to reverse and concludes that the any qualified provider provision does not create a right enforceable under Section 1983. Does that create then a situation where other states may do exactly what South Carolina did and remove a provider like Planned Parenthood or another provider from its approved Medicaid provider list? Is that the effect of this? Is that states then have a free pass to do whatever they want?
Well, I guess the question is do states have a pass to determine who is qualified to be a provider as otherwise required by federal and state law? And the answer is yes. And that's the current status quo too. We're focusing on this Fourth Circuit case, but I believe the en banc Fifth Circuit has decided that Texas at least was allowed to remove Planned Parenthood from their qualified provider designation. And I anticipate that if the Supreme Court comes out and says that that there is no authority to sue under 1983, that more states will likely follow. But even if they don't, and they come out the other way and says that Planned Parenthood may sue, I don't know that that resolves the ultimate merits issue either. And I would not be surprised to see other states embark on a similar project. You know, sure, maybe there is a right to sue if a provider is removed, but that doesn't mean they have a right to win their lawsuit. And the question is what will they have to show and what remedies are available under 1983? And I haven't dug too deep into this, but I don't know what relief Planned Parenthood is seeking in South Carolina, whether the 1983 remedies available allow for reinstatement. I know that that is often a difficult question of remedies, whether they're seeking damages. That's also sometimes difficult when it comes to a state, but if the only way to get reinstated is through the administrative process, I'm not sure that the federal district courts will be able to give them the relief that they want, which itself is its own issue. But, you know, that's one that is a little bit coloring outside of the lines. I don't know how that was litigated or what the current state of the law is on those. But I think there are all sorts of future arguments to be made by both of the litigants in this case about whether what South Carolina did is permissible or not, both on the sort of preceding jurisdiction, standing, all of those necessary first step bars, and then, you know, eventually on the merits too.
Well said. We're gonna have to leave it with that. The case is not Avengers Endgame. It's just an opening skirmish in what will likely be several rounds. So thank you so much, Eric, for your commentary today. And Kayla, we'll turn it back to you.
I'll echo those thanks to you both. Really appreciate you carving out this section of your days and sharing your expertise and insight. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at bedsocforums@bedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website, your emails, for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.